If you would, take your Bibles and open them to the book of Jeremiah, chapter 40. Jeremiah, chapter 40. Remember, if you will, we made the statement a couple of weeks ago that it was our intentions to bring to a close our study in the book of Jeremiah as well as Isaiah. We're studying Isaiah on Sundays, Jeremiah on Wednesdays. And that will bring a conclusion to our study of the divided kingdom. We've been in this particular study for quite some time, but there's been so much information that I think that we've gleaned that will help us not only to be better Bible students, but to see some of the things that went on during the times of the divided kingdom and what those digressive tendencies led to. Remember now, if you will, when we conclude Jeremiah and Lamentations next week, and then we bring a close to the book of Isaiah very quickly also, it'll close down our study of the divided kingdom. I wish there was some way that we could really wrap our minds around what was really happening in Jerusalem during this period of time and Judea. Remember, if you will, we said that Isaiah started his prophetic work during the beginning of the Assyrians going into Assyrian captivity, 10 of the 12 tribes going into Assyrian captivity. During the times of Hezekiah, king of Judah. We said that Jeremiah began his prophetic work during the days of Josiah. Had it not been for the work of Hezekiah and the work of Josiah and good prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, more than likely Judah would have gone into captivity about the same time as did the 10 other tribes in the Assyrian captivity. But because of two good kings and their influence, and the prophets prophesying and preaching the way they did, God allowed Judah and Jerusalem to exist about 150 years longer than did the 10 other tribes. Now, when we conclude this study, we're going to basically begin a series of studies that would include two books, the book of Ezekiel and the book of Daniel. Of course, those two books are very much like our book in the New Testament, Revelation, in the sense that they have some language in it that appears to be very difficult to work with and comprehend. But it's going to deal with their stay in Babylon for those 70 years, and then, of course, it'll bring a close to that study and we'll begin their departure from Babylon back to Jerusalem. And so it's a real interesting study that will kind of bring to a conclusion our Old Testament study as we begin back into the New again. But remember, we also said last week that we were going to look at chapters 40 through 45 of the book of Jeremiah. And what that section is going to do, it's going to talk about the conquest and the destruction of Judah and the words that Jeremiah has to say about that destruction. As I said, it's hard for us to really wrap our minds around what was really taking place. Jeremiah, as well as Isaiah, had a very difficult time to work under. In spite of the prophetic work that Jeremiah did, the people of his day refused to listen to what he had to say. That's the very reason that God is sending them into Babylonian captivity is because of their disrespect and their lack of concern about how God would want them to live and the examples that they were supposed to live by. Remember, they had really attached themselves to the idolatrous way of life. Oh, they would still go to the temple. They would still offer sacrifices. They, I guess, thought that because they had Abraham's blood in their veins, that they could get away with, God would approve and tolerate them worshiping and serving these idols. But the time had come when God was going to bring it to a close and bring it to an end. Jeremiah not only had to prophesy during this period of time, went to prison because of his prophetic work, but he literally had to watch as Nebuchadnezzar took his Babylonian armies and circled the city of Jerusalem and besieged it for better than 2 years before he broke the walls in and came into the city. Burned the city, stripped the temple of all its wealth and valuables, and took the remaining part of the children of Israel back into Babylonian captivity, those that he didn't slaughter with the sword. Now remember, if you will, we've already said that over 10,000 had already been taken away. This procedure went on over a series of years and time. Remember we said that 10,000 were taken away the first time, along with men like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were already down in Babylon, already serving the king there, while the king, for all practical purposes, the Babylonian king, was ruling and reigning over Judah and Jerusalem, while a large majority of them were still there. Now notice, if you will, when we began to talk about the destruction of Judah, we're going to begin in chapter 40 talking about what not only Jeremiah said, but what Jeremiah saw. Now in chapters 40 and 41, what we're going to talk about and read about is the assassination of a governor by the name of Gedaliah. Remember, if you will, this particular governor was appointed by the king of Babylon himself. So for all practical purposes, the kingship of Judah was a thing of the past. They were under the power of the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon could appoint their kings or their governors, and Gedaliah was chosen to be the governor over the remaining group of people that were still left in captivity in Babylon. Notice, if you will, it says the word of the Lord in verse 1 came to Jeremiah from the Lord. After that, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had let him go from Ramah when he had been taken, being bound in chains among all that were carried away captive of Jerusalem and Judah, which were carried away captive unto Babylon. The captain of the guard took Jeremiah, said unto him, "The Lord thy God hath pronounced this evil upon this place. The Lord hath brought it and done according as he hath said, because you have sinned against the Lord and have sinned against the Lord and have not obeyed his voice. Therefore this thing is come upon you." In other words, the people had pushed God so far that Jeremiah's messages from God was, these people, they did it to themselves.
Yeah, he worked with them time and time again.
Oh my goodness, just look at all the prophets we've talked about as we've studied through the divided kingdom. How many he had sent time and time and time again. They did not listen. They did not heed what he had to say. Verse 4. Behold, I loose thee this day from the chains which were upon thy hand. If it seem good unto thee to come with me into Babylon, come, and I'll look well unto thee. But if it seem ill unto thee to come with me into Babylon, forbear. Behold, all the land is before thee, whether it seemeth good or convenient for thee to go thither. Now notice, if you will, how this ends in verse 6, or this particular conversation. It goes on to say in verse 5, now while he was not yet gone back, he said, go back also to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon hath made governor over the city of Judah. Dwell with him among the people, or go whithersoever it seemeth convenient of thee to go. So the captain of the guard gave him victuals and a reward, and let him go. Then went Jeremiah unto Gedaliah, and dwelt with him among the people that were left in the land. So notice, if you will, you've got Daniel already in Babylon, inside the city of Babylon, and you've got Ezekiel outside the city with the remainder of the people, and they're going to be doing their prophetic work there. Jeremiah could have gone to Babylon with the king and the rest of the people, but he makes a choice to stay back in Jerusalem and to stay with the remainder of the people that was going to be left behind. Now we're going to notice in verses 7 through 12 that once many of the people that had been scattered abroad realized that there was a remnant that was going to stay in Judah and stay in Jerusalem, that the Babylonian king was going to allow a group to stay back in Babylon, back in Judah. That wasn't the case when the Assyrians came through. Remember, if you will, they took everybody out. And then they replaced them with people that they took captive in another country or in other places. So they just kind of made an exchange. This group goes here, this group comes there. But the king of Babylon was going to be a little bit differently minded. He said, I've got 10 or 15,000 already down here. I'm going to leave a group here, and Gedaliah is going to be my governor. He's going to watch out and see that the people are doing okay, send word back what's going on. And if old Jeremiah wants to stay, that's fine with me. Let Jeremiah stay. Jeremiah said, I'm going to. Well, when all of this came down and the people heard it, remember, people scattered. You've got people that scattered from the 10 of the 12 tribes that the Assyrians took. And you've got people from Judah and Jerusalem that scattered. And then they may have gone as far away as places like Egypt or some of the surrounding countries. But they find out what's going on. Guess what happens? They say, we'll go back to Jerusalem. We'll go back to Judah. So there was a return or an influx of people that was added to a small remnant that the king of Babylon made the choice to leave behind. Notice, if you will, you begin in verses 7 through 12, and it talks about the scattering of these people. And it mentions a fact in verse 8 that they came to Gedaliah, even Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and Johanan, and Jonathan, the sons of Kariath. And it ends by saying this, the son of Machiat, they and their men. So it talks about a group of people that comes to the governor, Gedaliah, and kind of makes an appeal. And here's what Gedaliah tells him in verse 9. Fear not to serve the Chaldeans. Dwell in the land, serve the king of Babylon, and it'll be well with thee. So notice what he says. Come on home if you want. You can stay here, serve the king, and you'll do okay. As for me, behold, I will dwell at Mizpah to serve the Chaldeans, which will come unto us. But you gather you wine, summer fruits, oil, put them in your vessels, and dwell in your cities that you may have taken. Now notice in verse 11. Likewise, when all the Jews that were in Moab and among the Amorites and in Edom and were in all the countries heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah that he had set over them Gedaliah, all the Jews returned out of all places, whether they were driven, and came to the land of Judah. So notice, if you will, you're getting an influx of people that basically had just scattered. And you can kind of understand why. You've got the Assyrians coming through and doing battle, taking people into Syrian captivity. You've got Babylon coming in and taking people into Babylonian captivity. Not only that, but you've got Babylon coming in and out of Judah as they were fighting battles and finally there to take the city itself and surround it, and the city would fall. Now, notice also, if you will, when you start in verses 13 through 16, Gedaliah is warned about an assassination attempt. Now, we've seen some of that happen in the divided kingdom. Remember how from time to time one king would take over and they would assassinate all the previous king's family so that no one would interfere with their kingship? Well, here's a group that has set up a plan that they're going to destroy or assassinate Gedaliah. But if you'll notice in verse 14, you're going to notice that once Gedaliah finds out about it, he doesn't think it would happen. And I guess that's understandable. He is a person that was picked by the king of Babylon. The last thing that you would think anybody would think about doing that was a Jew would come in and try to assassinate the person that the king of Babylon sent over to take care of his country. So Gedaliah kind of backs off and he says, no, I don't think that's going to happen. You start in the first three verses of chapter 41, and guess what you read about? The murder of Gedaliah. They came in, they had a big meal and a big feast, and they killed him and his people with the sword. Caused a little problem. You could kind of see that. Because you know what was going to happen. Word was going to get back to the king of Babylon. Now, if you'll notice in verse 3, it mentions the man that came up with a scheme and pulled off the dirty deed. His name was Ishmael. Slew all the Jews that were with him, even with Gedaliah at Mizpah. Now, in verses 4 through 10, what Ishmael is going to do is just like all the rest did. Here comes some group in that had been affiliated with Gedaliah. And guess what old Ishmael's going to do? He's going to put the sword to them. And another group of the same party comes in. He says, you know what? You might not want to take our life because we dug a bunch of cisterns out there outside of Jerusalem, and we have buried enormous amounts of wealth in those systems. And if you take our life, you're not going to know where they are. And you're not going to get to share in the bounty that's in those systems. So these people kind of made an attempt to lay a plan to join with Ishmael. But in the end, they turn on Ishmael. And he has to get out of town in a hurry himself. Now, as you start in chapter 41, you begin in verses 11 and go through 18. These people, because of kind of a little civil war going on between these two groups, and because they know that the king of Babylon is going to be upset because they've taken the life of his governor, they said, you know what we might ought to do? We may ought to slide right up into Egypt. Because you see, at this point, for some reason, Egypt was still standing. The king of Babylon had destroyed the city of Nineveh and overthrown the whole Assyrian Empire. He had taken pretty much everything around him, was inside Judah now, having Jerusalem surrounded, had appointed a governor there, but some way, somehow, Egypt was still standing. He had gone up on one occasion, remember, tried to fight with him, lost the battle. Was called back home, comes back now. He's in the area. Here's a group says, you know, we're going to slide up to Egypt. Some had already gone. They were living in Egypt. So they go to Jeremiah and they ask Jeremiah, said, Jeremiah, we need a little information. Had a friend of mine. His dad was a big plantation owner over in the Delta, and they had two or three cotton gins. This preacher friend of mine was telling me when he was in high school, he was in the gin yard there, working around the gin yard, went in there, and a group of men come in and said, Brother Mayhew, I'd like for you to give me some advice. And Brother Mayhew said, I don't give advice. That's what you need to get on out of the gin house. I don't give advice. And he said, Daddy, wasn't you kind of rough on them people? All they wanted was your advice. He said, son, they didn't want my advice. They wanted me to agree with them that what they wanted to do was the thing to do.
Yeah.
So he said, I'm not in the advice-giving business. That's kind of what was going on here with old Jeremiah. They come to Jeremiah. They said, Jeremiah, I want you advice. We're thinking about traveling up into Egypt. They really didn't want Jeremiah's advice. They wanted Jeremiah to say, yeah, go right on up to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you need to do.
That's the way we
remember, were. They were already been told, you stay in Judah, you serve the king of Babylon, and you stay there till this siege is over, and you're going to be okay. But if you run, you're going to be in trouble. Well, guess what they do? You look in chapter 42, and they're going to make their trip right on up into Egypt. And Jeremiah goes ahead. It took him a week to get a reply from God. You know, it's just hard for us to envision that, isn't it? They come to Jeremiah, said, Jeremiah, talk to God. Get an answer from God. 7 days later, God decides to answer Jeremiah. And Jeremiah says, okay, I got your answer. You better not go to Egypt. Because if you go to Egypt, you're going to die with the pestilence, the sword, and the famine. And you think that Egypt is a place for protection? The king of Babylon is going to walk all over Egypt. He's going to destroy Egypt as well. And that is exactly what happened. So now you've got the Babylonians. In Judah, they go up to Egypt, and they, of course, take Egypt. And now look at the condition that those people's in. They're going to be killed by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. Chapter 43 is basically Jeremiah is giving them the prediction of Nebuchadnezzar taking his army and going in to the city itself and basically destroying the city. Chapter 44 is a message from God concerning the Jews and their love for the idolatrous lifestyle that was existing not only in Judah, but in all the countries round about them. Don't you remember when we spent a year studying about Sinai and we talked about how that God took the children of Israel now out of Egyptian bondage. He had been there 400 years, marched them down to Mount Sinai, kept them there a year, gave them his law, sent them on their way to the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. What were they told to do? You stick to my word. You live by my word. You serve me with your heart, your mind, and your soul. You should never worship any other God other than myself. And here they were now, bowing down to these heathen gods that they had created for themselves in Judah. Some ways that they had picked up from the nations round about them. And were bowing down to these Egyptian gods. And you know, it's kind of sad if you notice in chapter 44, the women kind of got into the picture. You can't see a woman doing anything like that, could you, man? But they get involved in this deal. And they're questioned about their idolatrous lifestyle. And you know what they said? Well, my husband said it was okay. Well, you see, God wasn't concerned about what their husband said because he had already told her, the wives and the husbands, you should have no other gods before you. And Jeremiah's message was, you're going to die. You're not going to make it out of Egypt. Now then, notice as we close out chapter 44, verse 30, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will give Pharaoh, king of Egypt, into the hand of his enemies and into the hand of them that seek his life, as I gave Zedekiah, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, his enemy, and that saw his life. Remember now, Zedekiah was the last king. And Jeremiah told Zedekiah, said, Zedekiah, you better not run. Bow down, surrender to Nebuchadnezzar when he comes into the city, and everything will be all right, and serve him. When old Nebuchadnezzar busted those walls down and came through those gates, guess what old Zedekiah did? He took his family and a group and they ran out the back gate. And they got caught. Slaughtered his 10 sons, put the eyes out of Zedekiah and took him in chains and took him down the back. Jeremiah said, that's exactly what's going to happen to Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He's not going to make it. I'm not going to allow. Remember he said, I'm fighting with the Babylonians. Can you imagine that? It's hard for us to envision now God telling His people, His chosen people, you've become so corrupt, so idolatrous, that I'm going to turn my back on you. As a matter of fact, you better give up when Nebuchadnezzar comes, because I'm fighting with them. Remember, time and time and time again, little old Judah, little Israel, had been victorious over and over and over again with much larger armies against them because God was fighting with them. They were instructed that way. Said, look, I'll fight your battles for you. You just be faithful to me and trust in me and serve me. Oh, they forgot that. They turned away from God. And Jeremiah told them, tell you what, Zedekiah, when the king comes in, you better bow down to him. Right now, Jeremiah is telling the same group of people that went up into Egypt. He said, look, I tell you what's going to happen. Pharaoh's going to fall. Just like Zedekiah fell. Now, chapter 45 is just a really short chapter, and that's where we're going to stop and pick up next Wednesday afternoon. We're going to pick up in chapter 46, and we're going to go through a great deal of that pretty quickly, because what it's going to do is deal with the foreign countries around Jerusalem and Judah. And then we want to really kind of get into Lamentations and kind of see and get us a physical picture of Jeremiah's heart, his feelings, what was going on as he saw what was happening to the city of Jerusalem and to the temple and to God's people. Chapter 5 is a 5-verse chapter that deals with a man by the name of Barak. And it's going to talk about his sorrow and his pain as he sees and kind of reveals what's going on around him and what's going on, what he and Jeremiah are seeing. Any questions or comments before we close our study and kind of get into our deep up? Any questions in regards to it? All right, we'll pick up next week, and if we can, we'll finish the book of Jeremiah. If not, we may have to let it overflow into one more week. But it's my intentions to try to go through, especially into Lamentations.
Hey, Brother Steve, I do want to say, as a nation, as a whole,
yeah,
I see we're living so much like that today. Just there's really not a lot of difference. I mean,
yeah, we've really been able to compare and contrast in our study of the divided kingdom to really see how over a period of time the children of Israel became weaker and weaker and weaker spiritually, and in the end wound up in Babylonian captivity, and the fleshly kingdom of Israel came to an end. Remember, we talked about two promises or two covenants that God made, one with Abraham. Your children are going to be like the sand of the sea and the stars of heaven. And he told David that once he died, when his body was in the tomb, from his loins would be one that would set up an eternal kingdom forever. And we've seen that come to be, because remember, the next king previous to Zedekiah, Coaniah, remember, Jeremiah told him, says, there's not going to be another earthly king set upon David's throne. Why? Because Christ was coming, and he would establish David's spiritual kingdom. Remember, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world, else would my servants fight.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling Billy a week or two ago, I've been really reading I like to read biographies, and especially of some of our older pioneer preachers. I've been reading the biography of J.D. Tant. I don't know whether any of you remember J.D. Tant or not. But he did a lot of preaching in Arkansas. He lived in Benton, Arkansas for a short while. Lived over in Memphis. Did preaching, over 6 or 8, 10 states. But he was basically a Texas man. Born or wound up in Texas. And lived there all of his life. He was just an old country preacher, self-taught preacher. And during that period of time, you may not remember it. I can kind of remember the tail end of that. What we know today is located preachers, that means a congregation will hire a preacher and he stays and works for that one congregation. That wasn't even heard of back then. You just didn't hire, quote, full-time preachers to preach. The elders and the deacons did the preaching and the teaching, and you would have preachers that would preach. I mean, Brother Tant would preach 10, 12, 15 meetings a year around, and they worked and they did their preaching work. I was telling Billy, I read an article, and he was making a statement about his work, and he said after he'd been preaching about 3 years, he said, I was closing my books out at the end of January. I told my wife, says, you know, we've had a pretty good year. Said, we've made $975 preaching this year. And then he began to think, he said, no, that's not right. Because, remember, brother and sister so-and-so gave us $500 to do their funeral. So he made $475 preaching for a year. And he said in the book, the most he ever made in 1 year was $2,500.
I thought that was interesting, too. They used to would go into town and chop cotton, do whatever That was very interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I was reading, and I thought this was interesting because he lived to be 80-something years old. And in 1937... he held a debate in Lone Star. Anybody know where Lone Star, Arkansas is? How far is it from here, Billy? You don't know? Lone Star, Arkansas. It was east of Greenwood, Arkansas, if that tells anybody from Arkansas folks anything. But in 37, he did a debate there with Ben Bogard. And He was kind of summing up his life before his preaching career came to an end. And he wrote an article in 1928 that was in the Gospel Advocate. He wrote a lot in the Gospel Advocate and the Firm Foundation. At that time, he was 67 years old. And he wrote this article in the Gospel Advocate. And he was talking about the work that he had done the previous year. That would be 1927. And he said he worked on the farm 5 months making a living for his family. Then he did 12 gospel meetings, 4 debates, and 8 other meetings he held. On top of that, he referred to it as preaching stages. And he made the point in that Advocate, and I thought it was a lot like what we've been looking at and learning in our study of the divided kingdom. He said, normally speaking, I have noticed that religious people or religious congregations, and especially he had been watching members of the church, he said they go through 3 stages. He said the first one, he referred to it as the fighting stage. And he said when the fighting stage starts, the people are younger, churches are young, the people are few, and they're humble, and they lean and trust on God. Pretty good trait, is it not? Mm-hmm. He said, when they go through that stage, that's the first stage that a religious group goes through. He referred to it as the fighting stage. I was reading the book of Deuteronomy. We studied that quite some time ago. You get to chapter 7 of Deuteronomy 6, chapter 6 and 7. You find old Moses, an aged preacher. Now he's led the children of Israel right to the brink of the Jordan, and he's reminding them what the responsibility that they're about to see. He said, I'm not going to get to go in with you. See, Joshua and Caleb's going to take them over. But he talked about their responsibilities, and here's what you need to do. He said, you need to trust in God, and you need to fight and go in and drive out your opponents. God's going to be with you. And you need to be firm. And Brother Tant said, I observed that these earlier churches, when they first started, they were hungry, they were energetic, and they were going to preach the gospel no matter what enemies came against them. And he said, then there's the second stage. And he called it the greatness stage. Now, you and I might can relate to some of this. Luke back there, he's far too young. He can't get this. But you and I can remember when congregations were formed in people's houses.
Yeah, I remember.
They would meet in a home somewhere every Lord's Day, back Sunday night and Wednesday night. And he said they go from that stage to a stage of greatness. In other words, they leave the homes, they get them a nice, comfortable building, and they kind of feel like, well, we kind of arrived. Our building is just as nice as the building down the street. Children of Israel did like that, remember? Oh, they got into the land of Canaan, but then they decided we need us a king just like the people around about us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Samuel was terribly upset. God had to remind Samuel, it's not your fault. They're doing it against me, not against you. Give them the king. Brother Tam said, I witnessed over the years how churches go from fighting movement to the greatness movement when they reach perfection and they just settle down and they get complacent. They don't do anything. They don't help in any way to spread the gospel to a lost and a dying nation. And then he said the third stage was an age of compromise.
Boy, you're preaching now.
And he said that's when you really began to get spiritually sick. And that's kind of the way it is in our society today. It's kind of sad to see how a man, when he was 67 years old, kind of wrote a review of what he had seen and observed in his preaching career. Said he baptized over 8,000 people in his career, doing meetings around. But he said toward the end of his career, he said, it's kind of hard for me to find a place to pray. See, he was an uneducated preacher. He didn't have one of the degrees from the Bible colleges, so he paid and helped a lot of young men go to them.
Mm-hmm.
But yet now he couldn't find a place to preach because he didn't have his preaching certificate. Didn't have his degree. Later on, a few days before his death, his son became a preacher. His name was Yeager Tant. Yeager preached in some meetings not far from where Gay and I lived, our first preaching work. And J.D., his daddy, held some 3 Brush Arbor meetings out there in that community. And some of the old-timers would tell me about them. Now, that was 1980, and these men were, oh my goodness, they were 70-some-odd years old. They were my age now. They were telling me about old Brother Tant holding those meetings. But he knew that his time was near. He'd had a stroke, and he was visited. He couldn't go to church on a Sunday before, nor could he go this Sunday, and he died that afternoon about 4:30. But he told some of the visitors came by his house, he said, well, Yater is coming in Tuesday. He was preaching up in Chicago. He said, I'm going to try everywhere in the world to hold out until Tuesday. And then I'm going to pass from this life out into eternity. Yater's coming. He died about 45 minutes later. He didn't get to see Yater. But it's amazing to think about what people like Jeremiah went through. But it's amazing what some of our old-timers went through as gospel preachers and what they had to go through and endure to preach the Word of God. I hope that we here can remain in that first stage, that fighting stage, and never get always be hungry.
Amen.
We want to hunger and thirst for the Word of God and grow spiritually and be concerned about the community and try to get the gospel to a lost and a dying world. If you're in the audience tonight, listening by way of Facebook, need to become a New Testament Christian, why not take the opportunity